Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Vice President Kamala Harris has re-energized the Democratic Party. But what does today's party represent? Is it still the Clinton-Obama party, or will it work to win back the working class? Minnesota Governor and potential vice presidential pick Tim Walz has been all over the media proudly touting policies like universal school lunches and higher education and gun control. Will we see the Democratic Party embrace widely popular progressive policies? What do you want to see from the Democratic Party? How do you describe today's party? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation. John has written, co-written, and edited over a dozen books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. His latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Hi, John. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Rose, it's a pleasure to be with you and an honor to be on with India.
Great to have you. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action, an organization that pushes Democrats to deliver for the multiracial working class and people of color and the young people that elected them. India Walton is joining us from St. Louis, where she is knocking on doors for Representative Cori Bush. Hi, India. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you, India. Since you're out on the ground knocking on doors, what are you hearing from people about this massive change that we've seen in the last couple of weeks with Kamala Harris now running for president?
You know, I think that folks seem to be pretty excited and a bit relieved. But there's one thing, particularly among progressives, that is still concerning, and that's the genocide that's happening in Palestine. And the lack of action on the part of this administration to make meaningful policy change, right? Like, we need the Biden administration and the future Harris administration to stop providing arms to Israel.
And you're hearing that a lot from people on the ground.
I'm hearing that a lot from people on the ground.
Wow. Is anyone talking about the changes that could be expected? I mean, we played part of the speech that Kamala Harris gave after she met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I mean, it definitely sounded a lot different from Biden. But the fact of the matter is Biden is still president right now. And he's making the decisions. And because she's vice president, by default, she's supporting him.
Right. So a lot of what I've been talking to folks on doors and on the phones and phone banks is that part, right? And I think that this is an election, you know, for a lot of folks in my position, Kamala is not our first and best choice, right? Like, Ruth Action 2 years ago was calling for Joe Biden to step aside and allow there to be an open primary process that included productive debates, you know, and we saw primaries being canceled all over the country in this sort of, I don't know the right word to put it, but like, we didn't have any other options, right? So now that the horse is out of the gate, we can't take that back. So at this point, we need to mobilize and we have to coalesce around Vice President Harris, because we cannot risk a second Trump presidency and we cannot risk the implementation of Project 2025.
Right. John, we'll talk about the Democratic Party and what it stands for. You've done so much work on this. But since India brought up Gaza, and that is what she's hearing from people as she's knocking on doors in St. Louis, what are your thoughts about what we might see from Kamala Harris on U.S. foreign policy? And do you think we'll ever see something different within the Democratic Party?
Those are two very different questions, and each of them deserve a lot of exploration. I won't go on for too long about it, because obviously we could take the whole show up with it. The fact of the matter is that what's going on in Gaza is horrific, unacceptable. It's got to stop. And yet the Democratic Party, which is the only party in a position to make it stop, has not really coalesced around this issue at all. There are people like Cori Bush, who India is out working for today, who have been out front and incredible on this issue. But most Democrats have been weak, and certainly the Biden administration especially, and that includes Kamala Harris. I've interviewed the vice president several times, and we've talked about Gaza. And I don't have any question that her language is different and better on this issue. But language is one thing. Action is another. I think that the vice president's not in a position right now to shift the policy herself. But there are two things that can happen. One, Biden and the Biden administration could shift policy. They should. That would actually be, I think, profoundly impactful on this election process. Number two, the vice president can do something that Hubert Humphrey did back in 1968. And that is ultimately, in 68, Humphrey was nominated for president, replacing Lyndon Johnson, who had stood down in a somewhat similar situation. Although Johnson was much younger, it was not so much an issue of his competence as an issue of real discomfort with the war in Vietnam. Over time, Humphrey moved to a stance that was at least somewhat more anti-war. And that was very, very beneficial of him, for him. But he didn't move fast enough and he didn't move far enough. And so I do think for Kamala Harris, that lesson of 68, although it's ancient history, is useful, right? The more distance she puts between her stance and that of the administration, frankly, the better, I think, because it's a very powerful issue for a lot of people, and one that I think if she were to take a more sympathetic stance toward the circumstances of the Palestinians, I think that would help her a great deal in a number of states. And overall, nationally, I think it would help her a great deal with young voters for whom this is a big issue. Now, so that you asked me about it, and I hate to go on that long, but let me just add one more exclamation mark or, you know, element of this. I think the switch, as India references, the switch from Biden to Harris in and of itself is highly consequential. And what I have heard as I've been around, and I'm in Southwest Wisconsin heading into Iowa, and I'll be in Nebraska tonight. I'm doing a big piece on the change in sentiment, you know, and how people are feeling around the country and how this might alter the whole electoral map. What I can tell you is there is so much enthusiasm for Harris that even where there is frustration with her position on particular issues, and there is, that enthusiasm right now is very palpable. I was literally, before I came on the show, I was in a campaign office for a rural Democratic Party out in southwestern Wisconsin. And I said, well, how's it going? And they said, you can't believe it. We literally have people coming in the door, you know, bringing in food, dropping off a radio, doing it. Like, people want to know how they can help. They had a picnic the other night. They thought usually, you know, a few dozen people. They had so many people, they were running out of food. And so something is happening here. It's very, very big. It extends way into places that are a little bit unexpected and potentially could open up the map. That doesn't detract from the importance of some of these issues we're talking about, but it is something to be conscious of.
Right, John. I mean, it is so interesting to see what's going on out there. It is just because things have been so intense over the last couple of years, and then just to think about a Trump-Biden match-off, which people were just so worried about this, and to just let yourself...
It was kind depressing.
Exactly. And I have to say, even the cynics among us, the political junkies among us, maybe the cynical optimists, to really kind of revel in this excitement and just to see people actually taking action and feeling like, oh, maybe it's not going to be so dark. I mean, it has been amazing to watch over 150,000 people on a Zoom call. And I have to say, I watched some of the White Dudes for Harris call, and to hear all of these men talking about their daughters and their mother, I mean, the bar is low for sure, but to talk about the importance of reproductive justice and to support women, I mean, I guess because things have been so ugly, this is just so refreshing to see. But at the same time, John, of course, we're going to talk about the policies.
That's right. And I'll just throw one last thing on here. I can sum it up very succinctly. I was in Eastern Tennessee the other day. I've been traveling a lot around the country. I was talking to a guy in his 70s, very solid Democrat, real progressive guy. And he said, and this was last week we're talking, he said, week or so ago, I was feeling entirely hopeless. Now I feel entirely hopeful. And, you know, you can analyze that however you want. You can like it, dislike it, agree, disagree. But the fact of the matter is I've heard variations on that all over the place. And I think it is rooted in the fact that this country still horrific challenges and failures over so long. People are looking at the fact that we've got this billionaire retread running against the child of Jamaican and Indian immigrants who went to a historic black college, who has, you know, assembled a record in public service, and is out there now holding these mega rallies with all this energy. And I just think there's an awful lot of people for whom, even with their frustrations and disappointments, are allowing themselves to hope.
It's such a good point. India, how are you thinking about this moment? I think that the working families endorsement is really interesting to talk about because on their Instagram page, they said, our members, our chapters, our national committee delegates voted overwhelmingly to support Kamala Harris. This election is bigger than any one person. It is about what kind of country we want to be and whether we'll let the rights and freedoms that our ancestors fought be taken away from us. Defeating the far right and electing Harris is a political necessity. It is not a final destination. I thought they did such a good job with this endorsement. What are your thoughts?
I have to tell you that, and it's funny that this comes up because someone asked me yesterday if I felt like WFP was my political home. And unequivocally, I think, especially under the leadership of Maurice Mitchell, and he said something that really resonates with me that I've been repeating to people. An endorsement is not a love letter. It's a chess move, right? So, I live in New York State, which is solidly blue. And after the first debate, we turned into a battleground. So, you know, I felt like I had the privilege to be able to sit this one out previously. But when Biden was only up by 8 points in New York State, a state that he carried by 20 something points in 2020, now that's cause for concern. And I think that the excitement around Kamala and the Harris campaign, I think the fundraising has been on point. I think the messaging for the most part has been great. And I think that appealing to the 18 to 35 electorate is what's going to be the difference maker in this election. And we know that in states where there is third party voting, that that working families party line is oftentimes the difference maker in the margin of victory for a lot of candidates. And I think that in for New York and in other states that have third party infusion voting, we'll see the same thing in this election as well.
John, what differences do you think we'll see between Biden and Harris, or do we know yet? John, are you still with us? We might be having a problem with John. India, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I was thinking he is somewhere in rural Wisconsin. No, I don't think we've gotten our national broadband quite there yet. But, you know, I think that one thing that I will say about women governing, right, is this innate ability that we have to be caretakers and caregivers and really care. And a lot of her messaging is centering around how we take care of families, how we take care of children, because we know that when we take care of working families, our entire communities are more able to thrive. So I think that the difference is going to be that we'll see a lot more policies that actually benefit working families. I think that, you know, Joe Biden was courageous and on point when he brought up the rent cap. I think that Kamala in doubling down on that was a smart move. But I think that we also have to talk about making healthcare affordable and accessible. We have to talk about making education affordable and accessible and revisiting our conversations about canceling student debt and strengthening workers' rights and all of this myriad of things that progressives have been asking for many years. And I think that we'll finally begin to see swifter movement on getting a lot of these things accomplished.
John, do we have you back?
You do. Okay, and I apologize. I actually have been, I'm in a remarkably rural area. So I apologize for that.
No, it's fine. Actually, John
should be stable now.
Okay, great. John is in a rural area and India is knocking on doors in St. Louis. So sorry if their lines go out. I want to ask you also this question, John, about what we might see the differences between Biden and Harris. And I think this is really important. Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez backed Biden until the very end. And that was so interesting to watch. They also had a meeting with Biden. And out of that, Bernie was so proud to tweet this. He tweeted, in the first 100 days of Biden's second term, he will expand Social Security and Medicare benefits, lower childhood poverty by making the child tax credit permanent, raise the minimum wage to a living wage, pass the PRO Act, end all medical debt, reduce the cost of childcare, start building affordable housing, reduce prescription drug costs. So it's interesting. Kiyanga Yamada Taylor had a piece in The New Yorker, and she thinks that Bernie and AOC made a strategic mistake by backing Biden. I mean, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but this is what I got out of her article. And she doesn't think they'll have much power with Harris because they backed Biden until the end. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think Harris will embrace what Bernie laid out here?
I think she will, because I think it's the winning agenda. And I think that Kamala Harris, who I've interviewed many times, Bernie Sanders, who I wrote a book with, are very, very similar people in a number of senses. They are both serious political figures. They are engaged politically. And they both recognize that the point of politics, ultimately, politics, not governing, but politics, is to win, right? To prevail on election day, to get enough votes, get them counted so that you can actually take power and do things. And I can tell you that the relationship between Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris goes back a long way. They have worked together on a lot of issues. They have not always agreed, but it has always been a warm and good relationship. And I think I don't know that the relationship with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is quite, you know, as deeply rooted, but I still think it's there. And so I guess I'm in the camp that says it wasn't a mistake. I understand what Sanders and AOC were doing. They are on the left, explicitly and unquestionably. And they want to move the Democratic Party to the left. They had a sitting president, even in his, you know, having a tough time after that first debate. But they had a sitting president who was willing to talk to them, who was willing to meet with them, to strategize with them about how to go forward and how to kind of maximize a working class agenda, maximize outreach to blue collar voters on a multiracial, multiethnic theme. And so I think that's what they were doing. I think they will do the same thing with Harris. I think that already one of the most fascinating things that Sanders has been doing, and I don't want to tell you he gets everything right, because there's things he gets wrong. And, you know, you can, with all these folks, you can always see the flaws in any political figure. But one of the things he's been doing that's been very fascinating this year is, because our media doesn't cover politics, right? Our media covers gossip, right? So it's not particularly interested in actual politics. But what Sanders has been doing under the radar is traveling all over the country to Ohio, to Wisconsin, to Minnesota, where he's been doing, in fact, I think he's with Ilhan Omar, either today or, you know, like right around now. He's traveling all over the country, going to often second and third tier cities. And what I mean by that are, you know, these are not the megalopolis, right? This is not the millions of people. It's not even the hundreds of thousands of people. He's been going to cities with, you know, 40, 50,000 or less. And holding rallies in union halls and, you know, community centers and out in parks. And I watched him doing this in Wisconsin one day in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, which is, it's not a very big city. There were 700 people standing in the pouring rain for an hour long speech from Bernie Sanders. And I got to tell you, he doesn't cut the speech short for rain. And it was a core, you know, working class, multiracial, multiethnic vision for America, right? And people were cheering like crazy. It was, you know, it was working. I think he will continue to do that through 2024. I think he will do that on behalf of Kamala Harris and her running mate. I think AOC will do the same. And ultimately, and I don't want to go on and on about this, but I'll circle around to this last point. Having interviewed the vice president a lot of times in a number of different settings, I can tell you, I don't know where she's going to end up. I can't, you know, read her mind, and I know all the pressures of politics. But I'll tell you, this is a woman who is very, very familiar with the progressive vision for America. She was raised with it by incredibly progressive parents. She came up as an anti-apartheid campaigner and an economic and social and racial justice campaigner as a young woman. She's been around a lot of this for a very long time, and my sense is that she will ultimately find a comfort zone with a lot of progressives. Doesn't mean that she'll be a perfect progressive. That's to be seen. But I think she'll have a comfort zone where she works with them as well as Biden often worked with progressives during his term as president.
Well, John, since you brought up Senator Bernie Sanders, who I should say is going to be 83 next year, and he's, like you said, he's not stopping. He's traveling around the country talking about all of the issues he cares about. I want to play a clip. Senator Bernie Sanders was recently on MSNBC saying it pains him, coming from a working class family, that so many working class people support Republican politicians who could care less about them.
That has a lot to do with the fact that the Democratic Party has over the decades turned its back on working people. And I think an important exception to that is Joe Biden. Joe has been the first president in American history to walk on a picket line, appointed a really strong Secretary of Labor, good people, National Labor Relations Board, and I think has put together the most progressive agenda and accomplishments of any president in modern history. But what I hope we can do in this campaign is let the working class of this country, white and black and Latino, understand that we understand the pain that they are experiencing. You know, we are looking at massive income and wealth inequality. Ali, the truth of the economy now, people on top are doing phenomenally well. 60% of our people live in paycheck to paycheck. We talked about healthcare. Our healthcare system is broken, dysfunctional. We got half of our elderly people trying to get by on $30,000 or less. We have a child care system totally broken. We have got to start paying attention to the needs of the working class of this country and stand up to powerful special interests who have enormous power, not only in the Republican Party, but I have to say in the Democratic Party as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders, recently speaking on MSNBC, he said more than 60% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And this is according to a Lending Club report. India, what about that? I mean, the Democratic Party has lost so many people to the Republican Party, so many workers, for many, many reasons. What are your thoughts about whether or not the Democratic Party is going to do what it takes to win back the working class?
Yeah, I have very strong opinions on this, being that in 2021, I won a Democratic primary and my Democratic opponent went and colluded with Republicans and, Trump donors to stay in office. I think that the Democrats have spent, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, I'm still a registered Democrat, right? But the Democrats have spent so long and so much energy trying to defeat progressives and beat us down that they have failed to put together a meaningful policy platform that people can believe in. The Democratic Party has been surviving off of fear and smear for too long, and people are just tired of living in survival mode and choosing the lesser of two evils all the time. I think that especially with, you know, the increase in social media and independent media, younger people are starting to see that what we've been offered are not our only choices. And they're choosing different. They're choosing to act and behave differently than, you know, the traditional vote blue, no matter who's.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And India, I'd love for you to tell us more about that story. India Walton ran her first campaign in 2021, and she beat Buffalo's four-term Democratic mayor in a primary upset. And so she'll tell us about how she did it, and then she'll tell us what happened during the general election. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action. She's joining us from St. Louis, where she's knocking on doors for Representative Cori Bush. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. He co-wrote with Bernie Sanders a New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Today, we're talking about the state of the Democratic Party. Kamala Harris has re-energized the party. But what does the party stand for? Who does the party represent? And I know that so many of you are waiting patiently, and we will definitely get to your calls after a break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the state of the Democratic Party. Vice President Kamala Harris has re-energized the party, but what does it stand for? Who does it represent? Will it work back? Will it work to win back the working class? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action. They push Democrats to deliver for the multiracial, working class, people of color, and young people that elected them. She's joining us from St. Louis, where she's knocking on doors for Representative Cori Bush. Before we get to calls, India, I'd love for you to tell us about this incredible experience that you had in 2021. You ran against a four-term Democratic mayor in Buffalo. And you won in the primary. So first off, tell us how you did that. What was your experience in talking with people in Buffalo?
You know, what we did was we went out and we knocked on doors and we had conversations. And a lot of it wasn't even voter ID. We did listening tours. We sent canvassers to doors to ask folks what were their everyday issues. And we developed a platform based on what people wanted. We took a lot of energy from the protests of 2020. We were in the midst of a pandemic. People were struggling. And we also had a very service-based campaign. When folks were in need of food, we went and delivered food. There was a housing complex where power went out. People were trapped in their apartments, elderly folks, and with no electricity. And we went and delivered pizzas and water. And, you know, we had volunteers up and down 10 flights of stairs doing wellness checks on our elders. So I think that people's basic needs and that feeling that someone cares about who they are is something that is very powerful and a driver for this new sort of movement that we see of how people are willing to not only vote their values, but to organize and mobilize other people to get out and vote too. And I think that's the big difference.
Okay, so you won against a four-term Democratic mayor. You had the support of the Working Families Party and the Democratic Socialists of America. How did the Democratic Party respond to your primary victory?
Oh, it was very hostile. I mean, you know, Jay Jacobs, the head of the party in New York State, compared me to David Duke.
David Duke?
He said that if David Duke were to win a primary, would we endorse him? Wow. It was a struggle to get the support of established Democrats in my city, in my county, in my state. But what I can say about not just the left, but progressives like Cori Bush, like AOC, like Senator Sanders, those are the people who coalesced around me and continue to encourage me even after I lost the general election, right? In my city, there's nothing for me to do politically. There's nowhere to put my energy, my excitement, my brilliance, my ideas. There's nowhere for that to go because I've basically been ostracized. However, when I went to see Senator Sanders, he said, you can't leave the Democratic Party because you are the future and you have to find a way to stay engaged. And I can say that people like Cori Bush and AOC and Jamal Bowman have made sure that I've stayed engaged and stayed active and stayed motivated to continue to create change within not only my community, but anywhere where I can be effective and helpful. And I think that's important.
John, we see this time and time again from the Democratic Party where a young progressive excites so many people. And then when it comes down to who the Democratic Party, the powerful Democratic Party supports, they tend to go for the establishment conservative, older Democrat. Can you talk about this, John? I mean, what is it going to take to change this?
Well, I wrote a book about it.
Yeah.
So I hate to tell you. And can I just say, I wrote a lot about India. When she won her when she was running before and when she won her nomination and afterwards. And it was exciting to write about her. And the fact that she didn't win that November race doesn't in any way detract from what was accomplished there, because she opened up the politics of a city. Did she open it up enough to make herself mayor? Not yet. But did she do what activists have done, progressive activists have done throughout history? Yes. And she did it in the best of ways with just it was a very beautiful campaign, and I loved writing about it. But I will tell you, the history is a horrible one. It's a nightmarish one. Going back in the book I wrote, I went back to the 1940s when Henry Wallace was vice president of the United States. And Henry Wallace was a passionate anti-fascist. He was also somebody who connected the fight against fascism in Europe with the fight against racism in the United States. He literally said that if you had a young black child born in the same city as a young white child, that young black child would live 10 years less. Their life would be 10 years shorter. And he said in the 1940s, our fight, our moral and practical struggle must be for those 10 years. And he was talking about, you know, a very sane, mainstream, rational vision for ending racism. And what they did was run him out of the Democratic Party. They literally threw him out as vice president of the United States. They wouldn't even let him give a keynote address to his own party's convention. And so that sets the tone for the book that I wrote. And it's, you know, again and again, when McGovern got the nomination in 72, a huge number of Democrats formed a group called Democrats for Nixon. They actually overtly campaigned for the Republican president of the United States during the Vietnam War. And so this is a painful, long story. However, what we're seeing right now, and I think it's a very big deal. You know, history, it is a long arc of history. It bends toward justice. It doesn't bend as quickly as we'd like. But there are people like India and others who are bending it right now. And there is simply no question that Joe Biden, a mainstream, relatively moderate, even somewhat conservative Democrat, chose to govern on most issues. These are domestic issues, not foreign policy, I'm sad to say. Right. But on most domestic issues, as a far more progressive figure than anyone anticipated. The reason for that is because Bernie Sanders, AOC, India Walton, and other people are there. And because they have demanded, not just demanded, they have shown what can be done, how you can mobilize people. And so I know there are folks who say give up, right? That the history is so overwhelming and it's so disappointing. But I actually, you know, I got to tell you, I feel like I'm reporting and writing in a time when history is being made. And I do feel that this energy around Kamala Harris's campaign, particularly if she picks a progressive vice presidential running mate, could be a further step forward, right? Not the whole journey, not everything you're looking for, but genuine progress. And so I guess I don't want to have rose-colored glasses. I know too much of the history for that. But I will tell you that India's experience was part of a long experience, a long struggle. But she got farther than people before her. And her getting farther will help someone else get even further beyond that. So I do think this arc of history is a good one.
Yeah. And I think what's frustrating to a lot of people, India, is that these policies that are often described as radical, how are you going to pay for this? You know, this is a Bernie policy. He's way out there. I mean, these policies are what so many other countries don't bat an eye at. It's just how they live. They don't go into medical debt. They don't go into student debt. They are able to pass to join unions. Of course, people have their issues, but the childcare is less expensive. I mean, on and on and on. I think that's what's so frustrating to a lot of people. That why is it so hard to get these basic policies? That, you know, when you take a trip to Europe, they cannot believe the amount of gun violence here. They cannot believe how expensive it is to go to college.
I have a theory, and I came up with this when I was visiting Vienna. I went to go check out some social housing models. And one thing about it is that everyone there is pretty homogenous. There's not much diversity. I think that the racism in our country is so deep and so ingrained. It is in the foundation of this country that we don't pass progressive policies because we are afraid that someday we will all be equal. And we think that some people are deserving of food, housing, healthcare, and a quality education, and that others are not. And that is what is keeping us separate. And that is what is keeping us in, you know, this two-party system that's killing us all. And I think that the rise of the multiracial working class, pro-labor, pro-union, pro-worker, pro-moms and dads and everybody in between is finally beginning to wake up and realize. And we are looking at a generation of people for the first time in the history of our nation that is becoming more progressive as we get older. And we are raising our children to believe that all folks deserve these things as human rights, right? And that there's no such thing as pulling yourself up from your bootstraps. You should have a place to lay your head at night. Mm-hmm. You should have access to healthy food, clean air and water. So I do think that, you know, to John's point, we are beginning to see that arc bend in a direction that is favorable to average Americans.
Can I jump in and just say a word that I, you know, I'm religious, so take it for what it's worth. Amen. What India just said is spot on. Mm-hmm. And again, if we go back, I was talking about my book, which makes a fine holiday gift, but there are other good books to buy now. But one of the themes that runs through that whole book is exactly what India is saying. In the 1940s and the 1950s, when people tried to move the Democratic Party to a progressive point at the exact point when it should have done so, it didn't do so because of race. Mm. It literally did not do so because of race. And the incredible thing is the guy I was talking about, Henry Wallace, the former vice president, he was pushed out of the party, right? And yet the segregationists who in 1948 left the party to oppose Harry Truman and the Democratic ticket were welcomed back into the Democratic Party in the 1950s to such an extent that the Democratic nominee for vice president in 1952 was a segregationist who had opposed the Democratic Party in 1948. So you understand, there has always been too much forgiveness for racism. There has always been too much forgiveness for divisiveness for the purpose of separating the working class. Right-to-work laws in the South were passed not by Republicans, but by Democrats who didn't want to have multiracial, multiethnic unions. And so when we talk about where the Democratic Party has to go, we do have to always talk about this economic justice agenda, all these issues that we're talking about. But as India has so well pointed out, we also have to talk about race. And if we don't, we miss the heart and soul issue that has held this country, held this party and this country back for generations.
Mm. Well, and so many of us watched Trump be interviewed yesterday at the Black Journalists Association,
which was shocking.
Talk
which
about
was just
race.
Unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah.
There's so many people waiting on the line. I just want to play one clip because in addition to what India brought up and you, John, the major media also, the way they frame these issues needs attention. So Minnesota governor and potential vice presidential pick Tim Walz was recently on CNN. And listen to how Jake Tapper frames this question.
Of all her potential running mates, you might have the most progressive record as governor. I know you were more of a moderate when you were in the House, but you've legalized recreational marijuana. You passed universal background checks on guns. You expanded LGBTQ protections. You implemented tuition-free college for low-income Minnesotans. There's free breakfast and lunch for school kids. Do you think your record is an asset to the ticket, or would it risk fueling Trump's attacks as you being a big government liberal?
What a monster. Kids are eating and having full bellies so they can go learn. And women are making their own health care decisions. And we're a top five business state. And we also rank in the top three of happiness. Look, they're going to label whatever they're going to label. He's going to roll it out, mispronounce names, you know, to try and make the case. The fact of the matter is, where you see the policies that Vice President Harris was a part of making, Democratic governors across the country executed those policies, and quality of life is higher, the economies are better, all of those things. Educational attainment is better. So, yeah, my kids are going to eat here, and you're going to have a chance to go to college, and you're going to have an opportunity to live where we're working on reducing carbon emissions. Oh, and by the way, you're going to have personal incomes that are higher, and you're going to have health insurance. So if that's where they want to label me, I'm more than happy to take the label.
Oh my gosh, Tim Walz is what he's saying to some of these hosts on TV is pretty incredible. Just quickly, John, the fact that Jake Tapper said, hey, you're a big government liberal. Is this going to be an asset to the terrorist ticket?
Yeah, no, look, it's if you want to find the great bias in American politics, it is against progressivism, right? It is against, you know, a mainstream progressive vision that, as you well pointed out, Rose, a couple of minutes ago, in any other country would be a middle of the road party, right? It wouldn't be the left. There are well-identified conservative parties in Europe that support much of what Bernie Sanders advocates for.
Exactly.
Right?
Bernie's and a centrist in many European countries.
So it's a huge bias. And India ran into it when she ran for mayor, right? She wasn't promoting something that was, you know, off the wall. She was literally promoting a response to challenges that her city faced that was rooted in talking to the people of that city. It was very mainstream stuff. And yet you just watch the media jump into this situation. I think what Walz is doing is really a big deal because he is pushing back on it. And he's doing so in this very common sense way. And I think that's one of the reasons why Walz, who was initially kind of at the bottom of the list of potential vice presidential running mates, has moved way up that list. He is definitely in the running. And the other guy who's done pretty well is Andy Beshear out of Kentucky. And the fascinating thing about Andy Beshear is he's in Kentucky, emphasize, underline, and he has been won three times in a row as a Democrat in tough races, advocating for women's rights, abortion rights, labor rights, and economic and social and racial justice. Even standing up for trans rights, which, you know, he got hit all over the place for, and yet it worked for him politically. And so what I'm telling you is what our media doesn't understand is that if you've got a good communicator who is out there talking about these issues and putting them in a common sense setting, people will vote for them. Not merely in New York or Wisconsin or Illinois or wherever. They'll vote for him in Kentucky. And so this is what Democrats desperately need to figure out.
We've got so many callers on the line. I wish we had another hour. Let's just take a few and then we'll get a response from John Nichols and India Walton. And thank you all for holding. Let's go to Lee in Kensington. Hi, Lee.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. John, it's nice to hear that you're not depressed in your voice or in your writing. My God, there's hope. So I have an idea. Maybe someone's already thought about this. Okay, she's looking at all these VPs, this governor, blah, blah, blah. When I listen to Sean Fain, the president of the UAW out of Louisiana, talk, now I haven't done a deep dive on this fellow, but could he be a VP pick? Can you guys talk about him? Because I grew up Berkeley High, you know, under, you know, Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco when Gavin Newsom came up, like blue, blue, blue Berkeley. But I've been spending time in northern Idaho and Montana and eastern Washington and listening to people that are, you know, plus 70 Trump counties, you know, planning local militias and how to shoot a gun. And then I hear Sean Fain, and I feel like he could break through, and not just in one state. He could break through the working class in so many places, you know, and it, you know, ties into what Bernie does. Anyway, I'll stop there. I feel like he's better than all these one state governor. If she wins in one state, great. You know, let's really be radical and pick Sean Fain.
Well, Lee, thank you for calling. Actually, Sean Fain is John Nichols' pick for VP.
That is true.
Right? Tell us a bit about Sean Fain and why you chose him, John.
I'll be very quick because I know there's a lot of other callers, but I really didn't set that call up, I promise. yesterday in The Nation, we all got to pick who we thought should be Kamala Harris's vice presidential running mate. I picked Sean Fain, and I didn't pick it to be provocative or to be, you know, like something that was different. I picked it seriously because Sean Fain leads a union with more than a million members and retirees. That means it's got a bigger population than a bunch of states. And he won an election to head that union by upsetting the establishment within the union. He literally beat the sitting leadership of that union. He then kept his promises to go out and win big contracts with the big three auto companies, then to move into the South to organize at Volkswagen and other plants across the South. And so here you have this individual with a remarkable track record who actually is unbelievably skilled at speaking to grassroots voters in multiracial, multi-ethnic settings across the country. And one of the things he's got going for him, and not everybody will, you know, jump up and be excited about this, but the fact is he's a Christian and he puts his advocacy for immigrant rights in the context of quoting from the Bible. He puts his advocacy for economic justice in the context of quoting from the Bible. He puts his advocacy for social justice in the context of quotes from the Bible. And not everybody, I'm not telling people they have to embrace that. I'm not telling people that's where they have to be. But I can tell you, this is a guy who could go into Tennessee, could go into Louisiana, could go into Idaho and hold his own. And he can certainly hold his own in the battleground states of the Midwest. Now, do I think the Democratic Party is going to pick him? Probably not. But do I think that we should always think about labor leaders and community leaders and activists as folks who have skill sets as significant as governors and senators? Yes, I do.
Just quickly, India, who would you like to see?
Well, you know, if we're talking rose-colored glasses and shooting for the moon, I would agree that Sean Fain would be a great pick. But we do know that we have a government, an institution that has been stood up to protect the ultra-wealthy and the millionaires and billionaires in this country. So I think realistically, if we could get a Governor Walz on the ticket, I think he has broad appeal. I think his name recognition is increasing by the day. So, you know, going back to this, if we're going to govern, we have to win first. I think that I would go with Walz.
So well, once again, I find myself saying amen to India.
Well, thank you for the call, Lee. If I want to take three more callers, if you can be as short as possible, because I know you've been waiting for a while, and I just want to make sure you get your voice heard. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Oh, thank you. Quickly, a couple points. One, I'm cautiously optimistic about her. I hope if she wins, and that's a big if, I'm hoping that she's going to give us a different policy on the environment, be much more strong about that, and I'd like to hear where she stands, and also on Gaza. And I just want to caution people, just remember, Barack Obama got elected, I voted for him twice, and to me, he was one of the biggest disappointments in a vote that I ever made, because he just turned his back on the very people that you're talking about, Sean Fain, with support. So let's hope that she can win.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. Let's go next to Joe in Cleveland. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I just wanted to raise a point. We don't only have two parties, the blue team and the red team. And unfortunately, because we won't recognize that we have multiple space for multiple parties, 3 to 7% who are not part of that, really, will align to one side and throw the election into the direction they want. So you have 3% or 7% of alleged conservatives and 3 to 7% of alleged...
Well, Joe, thank you for the call. Sorry to cut you off. I just want to take Peter in Florida, and then we'll get final thoughts. Hi, Peter.
Hi. What occurred to me as far as being limber or rigid, the two parties, I'm just saying, remember George Santos in New York? Everyone went down the Republican Party line and elected a criminal. But what India reminded me is, or made clear, is that even the Democrats can be rigid in their own way. Everyone is susceptible to being rigid to protect their turf. Something should we look out for, huh?
Well, thank you for the call. Just a couple minutes left. Final thoughts from both of you. We also have an email from Cliff who says, I'd like to see the Democrats go more on an ongoing campaign mode. That's what's needed to make social change. They could be much better communicators, doing the kind of outreach your guests are talking about more often. They could also make up the gaps in civics education. People need a better idea of how the system actually works. The myth that the president decides everything is one of the most corrosive ideas in American politics. Great point, Cliff. India, your final thoughts?
I agree that Cliff has a great point. I just want to, again, thank you for having me on. Thank my colleagues at Roots Action for, allowing me the space to continue to explore where I am most useful politically. And I'm just happy that I'm growing in that. And I would encourage folks to go and check out a lot of the work that we're doing. Follow us on social media or visit us at rootsaction.org.
Thank you, India. And final thoughts from you, John?
When I interviewed Kamala Harris the most recent time, we talked a lot about her childhood, and we talked about the fact that her parents, a very progressive economics professor and an equally progressive cancer researcher, were very involved in the anti-war and civil rights movements of the 1960s. And she said she had a stroller's eye view to the struggle to make real the promise of the United States, i.e. they took her to demonstrations when she was a little girl. I am happy to live in a country where it is possible that such a person might be president of the United States. I don't think that's going to solve all our problems, but I think it's an evidence of progress. And I think the next evidence of progress I'm looking for is the day when India Walton is elected as mayor of Buffalo, New York.
India, do you plan to run anytime soon again?
I don't know that I want to be an executive. I think I'm more of a policy and legislative person. And I'm really disappointed with my congressperson who just went to the House from Buffalo, who is now voting with Republicans to suppress data from the Gaza Health Ministry. So maybe there might be a run for Congress in my future. I don't know.
I will amend my statement to say mayor of New York or mayor of Buffalo, New York, or member of Congress.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. His latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action. She's been joining us from St. Louis, where she's knocking on doors for Representative Cori Bush. India and John, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Great honor. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.